You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, SpyCast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about SpyCast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make SpyCast better, and you can help. So we're joined today by Andrei Soldatov and Irina Baragan. Close enough, I think. I'm very happy that I got those right. And they're co-founders of Agentura.ru and co-authors of two books widely available here in the United States, The New Nobility, The Restoration of Russia's Security State and the Enduring Legacy of the KGB, and The Red Web, The Kremlin's Wars on the Internet, which was originally released in 2015, but has now been re-released with new information in the U.S. elections of 2016. Their work has been featured in the New York Times, Moscow Times, Washington Post, Online Journalism Review, Le Monde, Christian Science Monitor, CNN, and lots of other places. And the New York Times has called their website, agentura.ru, a website that came in from the cold to unveil Russian secrets. So welcome, and thank you for joining us here on SpyCast.
Thank you very much for having us here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I want to ask a question that I think is going to be on a lot of people's minds. What drove the two of you to begin investigating Russian intelligence and security services? Because this seems, sadly, now more than ever, like a job with a very short life expectancy. Just in the last couple days, there was a Russian talk radio journalist, Tatiana... who was stabbed in the throat, you know, just a couple of days ago. And I think people out there will understand where journalists that speak up against the Kremlin... find an untimely demise. So what drove you to do what could arguably be one of those dangerous jobs around?
You are right about Tatiana Felgengauer. She's better now. She's a friend of us, so we are very worried about this. But it was not always like this, because when we became journalists, it was back into 1996, and it was absolutely free Russia, and we had that time absolutely free press. There was no pressure on the journalist at all, and journalist was very popular, and it was, I don't know, a very, very well paid job. And we were both 20 years old, and all journalists, most of journalists in Russia was, I don't know, in the age of 20, 25 years old. So that was great times. And we started working as a journalist, and we were happy with this. But when Vladimir Putin came to power, we were very furious because we knew that he was from the KGB, and we didn't like that. And what we decided to do, we had no idea that Putin will be forever or for 17 years. We were sure that it is, I don't know, maybe for some period, like 4 years. Mm-hmm. But we understood that as a person from the KGB, he have to infiltrate into the Russian government a lot of people from the KGB, a lot of former KGB offices. So we decided to set up a website and called it agentura.ru, because we wanted to gather information on these people and to publish it, make it publish, because we make it public, because we thought that we operate in this way, we could have a lot of, we could gain a lot of popularity. What was our idea? That wasn't something about to be brave journalist or people who are always in danger. We just wanted to be popular.
Right. It was a very hot topic, and of course, it was really difficult if you are very young to enter this field, especially if you are not former security agents, and we are journalists. We have no security background, but we wanted to find some inspiration, some example to follow. And our inspiration for years was the website, the American website, actually, Federal Academy of Sciences Secrecy mm-hmm. Project,
yeah.
run by Steve Aftergood,
yep.
who's amazing. And we thought, well, probably we can do something similar in Russia to set up a watchdog, essentially, on the Russian security services. That was our initial idea. Of course, we understood very quickly that it couldn't be... Well, Russia is not the United States, and you cannot, say, send all these FOIA requests to the Russian government asking them to, requesting them, basically, to declassify some documents. Mm-hmm. We understood that it should be more journalistic, that we need to do more investigative journalism, and that was our approach, has been our approach ever since. We, of course, with the time, some... of our we shifted a lid and we began with the focus on counterterrorism and counterintelligence and rivalries between the agencies, this kind of thing. By 2009, probably 2009, we understood that the internet would be the next battlefield. So we began digging into this field, trying to understand what's going on with the Russian surveillance techniques, with filtering, with Putin's idea how to control the internet, and then we got the Moscow protests, mm-hmm. and before that the Arab Spring, and it was absolutely clear that the Kremlin got scared of the internet, and it launched a massive offensive on internet freedoms. So it was a kind of background, and we decided that we need to do something about it and to write a book. And finally, in 2015, we published The Red Web.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, you both spent some time being talked to by the FSB. I don't know if you use the word interrogated, but I'm not going to put words in your mouth.
It was correct, mm-hmm. interrogated.
I mean, are they trying to very subtly warn you to start looking in different directions or looking at different things, or... I mean, how seriously do you take their pushback against your work? How seriously do you take their warnings?
The problem was that they started this investigation, there were several of investigations of the FSB against us. And the very first one was very educational, because that was the moment we understood how they work to some extent. And back then it was 2002, and there was a time when we got a major crisis in Moscow. The theater was taken mm-hmm. hostage by Chechen separatists. And the problem was not only this situation, but also the way how the security services handled this crisis. The security services, finally, they stormed the building and lots of people died because a poisoning gas was used. So we were really critical. We published some stories, and we were determined to proceed, to keep going. So when we were summoned to Lefortovo prison, because that's the place where you are interrogated by the FSB, actually
right.
in prison. So... I was told very straightforwardly that I need to stop this investigation because it's kind of in national interest. And a very strange theory was presented to me. The idea was that we questioned back then the number of victims. And the theory, which was really popular among the FSB, at least they told us that it was very popular, that according to some strange estimates, for Islamist suicide bombers. It's considered to be a success if one suicide bomber took with him at least six people. If it's more, it's better. Mm. If it's a victory. If it's less than six, it's a disaster. And the idea of the FSB was to tell us, look, could you please reduce the number of victims, because this could prevent the next attack
right.
of happening. And of course, it was just nothing. I mean, there was no sense in it. And in 2 years, we got this tragedy in Beslan when
right.
the school was taken hostage. Lots of people died. But that was the way how the security services explained it to themselves, why we need to put pressure on journalists.
I want to ask, I mean, a lot of people out there who are listening understand what the FSB is now more than ever. Even those who had no idea what those initials meant know more now after November of last year. But maybe people don't understand the idea that this is an organization that was intended to be, or at least envisioned to be, somewhat like the FBI here in the United States, where the SVR was supposed to be the Foreign Intelligence CIA Security Service. Essentially, the SVR is a non-player at this point to many extent. And the FSB, because of who led it at one point, perhaps, and because of counterterrorism and kind of the purview of the former Soviet states being part of FSB's purview, now they're all NATO nations. Can you talk a little bit about how the FSB has gone from the FBI to the most dominant organization
frankly
in Russia?
Speaking, the FSB have never been like FBI, because even in the early 90s, when the FSB just was born, it was an organization which combined much more functions than the FBI. It wasn't only law enforcement agency. It was a law enforcement agency and also counterintelligence agency and also some kind of big powerful structure, which is some kind of control over the people's mind.
Right.
Because since 1900, to be precise, the FSB got its investigative department in 1995. That means what kind of, if you are a law enforcement agency, what kind of investigation are going to carry out?
And also, it was something about the name, because the initial idea of Yeltsin was to, when he actually split the KGB into different parts, his idea was firstly to make a counterintelligence agency. That's why the first name for the FSB was FSK, with the K meaning counterintelligence. But in 1995, thanks to the Chechen War, Yeltsin became sort of nervous and scared of what's going on, and he wanted to give more powers to the FSB. That's why he changed the name, and FSB, he changed FSK into the FSB, B meaning security, безопасность, security. And it's a much broader term. It actually could include anything.
Right.
It could be national security, informational security, any kind of things. And so we actually believe that already in 1995, we got some sort of resurrection of the KGB. They got back the investigative department, the prison system, the political surveillance unit, lots of things. And in 1998, they got some powers over the internet, which was very small but significant. So, yes, it was very different from the ABI from the beginning. And also, there was an interesting thing about intelligence. We had this system in the KGB back in 70s and 60s that, you have this so-called first chief directorate in charge of sending people abroad and trying to recruit foreigners. But what happens if, say, you have some foreigners coming to the Soviet Union? Of course, back then it was not a very often thing. I mean, not a lot of foreigners were going to the Soviet Union, but still, you need to have some people on the ground. And for that, they build a local widespread network of so-called first sections in every local branch of the KGB. So when the KGB was split and you have the first chief directorate turned into SVR, you still have this local network.
Right.
And you need to find a way how to do with them and actually to find tasks for them. So when Putin was the director of the FSB, there was an idea that they need some sort of coordination body. So they built something in the headquarters of the FSB right in Moscow to sort of coordinate all these first sections inherited from the KGB. But once you get something in the very headquarters, then you can develop it.
Right.
And immediately, actually in 2 years, they became very ambitious. And I think already by 2006, we spotted that they adopted as their symbol a globe. Which is a sign of ambitions, actually, that these guys, they wanted to spy everywhere. And now right. the FSB is our third intelligence agency.
So it used to be a joke in the United States that NSA stood for no such agency because it was so secret and no one knew anything about it. Now it's a lot more open. And it almost seems like FSB is adopting some of those old ideas. No one knows what the budget is. No one knows how many people are actually working for the FSB. I mean, that's not widely known. I mean, yes, a lot of American intelligence agencies, the number of people working for CIA is still classified, but people have an idea. But there's no, it could be as many as 200,000, 300,000 people working for the FSB.
As we wrote in our first books in Unability, at like 200,000 people who worked for the FSB at that time. But this is really only the idea of how many right. people could work for them, because this number have never been disclosed.
And it doesn't include people who are informal informants, you know, people who are talking to FSB. Let me ask you another. The power of FSB, from what I know, has come through the exploitation of terrorist incidents, or what some have argued are, in the United States, we call them false flags, like the Moscow apartment bombings right before Putin's election in 2000, like Beslan, you know, where like the apartment bombings themselves led to the Second Chechen War and the power of the security services. And then, you know, do you see that now? Because you see them spreading out into Syria and other places around the world with counterterrorism operations. Has that been used, whether purposely or not? I'm not saying say they did all the bad stuff, but are they taking advantage of counterterrorism being such a big deal around the world to increase their power every day?
That's actually a very interesting question, because it looks like Putin, by probably 2015, became a bit disillusioned with the FSB. Because we got this big political crisis in 2011, 2012, with the Moscow protests and with some uncertainty, and Putin was scared, actually. He was scared by social media, by Facebook. He believed that it was a kind of big conspiracy run by the U.S. State Department. And the problem was that the FSB, which was given so much powers, they were not that powerful. Mm. I mean, they failed to warn him about what was coming to him. And there was at least one statement, public statement, by the deputy director of the FSB, who said, look, we have no means to deal with Facebook. We don't know what to do. So he wanted to do something about these guys. And actually, he decided to abandon this idea of the new nobility, that the FSB should be seen as the new, actually, aristocracy of Russia, providing all kinds of answers to all kinds of questions. So, but it doesn't mean that actually they suffered in terms of their powers. What he did, he stripped them of some unusual powers. For example, they are not anymore in charge of defining the Russian national ideology. But at the same time, Putin actually prompted them to be much more aggressive in terms of repressions inside mm-hmm. of the country. Over the last 2-3 years, we got some crazy events. Like, we got governors sent to jail, we got ministers in jail, we got deputy ministers in jail, some federal officials at the level of the Kremlin, and we have some directors of theater directors sent to jail.
We might have some high-level officials sent to jail soon too. So we're in some. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, but it, but sort of reflects that
but
actually
that's unusual for the Russian for the yeah. Russian Putin system because right. people high positioned people always when they lost their positions they just was retired.
Right. Yeah.
But they were not
put in jail.
They were not put in jail.
Now it's something different. Mm-hmm. It means that Putin actually he tries to make the Russian system much more repressive, to use repressions as a tool to control them. And of course, the FSB became very instrumental. It doesn't mean that they became more independent. I would say on the contrary. Now they are more tightly controlled by the administration of the Kremlin, but they're very aggressive. And it has its effect.
And it seems that, I mean, you bring up the KGB as kind of the natural ancestor of the FSB, but I think of more of the Cheka as being more apt to some of the
oh,
tactics.
Oh, no, they're not so terrifying.
Yeah.
No.
I hope so, because yeah. they do not shoot people on the streets. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
but they have adopted, have you seen the we have in the museum the 20th anniversary pin of the FSB from 2014, and it adopts the ideology, the exact imagery of the old Cheka anniversary pins from 1922 and 1927 and 1932. I mean, it's...
You're absolutely right. But these guys are really are very inventive. Say, in the 1990s, when I very first time I went to the FSB museum in Moscow on Lubyanka, and it's now it's kind of... you cannot get to this place, but back then it was possible. So I was really surprised to find that Dzerzhinsky, as a founder of Cheka, was presented in this museum as a guy who actually he tried to reform and modernize Russian economy. Just like, what? That was his main role in the Russian society, but that was the way. They wanted to portray themselves as people who were really interested in the, well, modernizing Russian economy.
Yeah, there's a lot of Stalinist revisionism going on also of some of the older generation, right. Unfortunately. Yeah. You brought up the idea of the 2010, 2011, 2012 being a scary time for Putin. This is really when the internet becomes a key component to all this, and this is your second book, The Red Web. It's hard for Americans maybe to believe this now because of how effectively the Russians were able to use the internet in the last year or so, which we'll talk about in a second, but I want to back up to kind of look at how paranoid, and you already kind of alluded to this, talking about Facebook and other things like that, how paranoid the Kremlin leaders were about the power of the internet, about how it could potentially be a subversive tactic by the United States because of Facebook and Twitter and those other things, and then mixed in with the same idea of the Arab Spring happening and a lot of things that were internet-powered and social media powered. You alluded to it, but can you get a little bit more into how the Kremlin saw this movement taking place and why it frightened them so much?
The security services, the Russian security services, have been paranoid about the internet from the beginning. But Putin was not. He really didn't believe in the internet, and it was a great thing for Russia because the internet have been developed until 2011, until 2012, absolutely freely. Nobody touched the internet, and we have no regulation on the internet until 2012 at all. You could post anything on the internet, and you couldn't be punished in any case. But after this protest, Putin was really into. I mean, when people went to street in Moscow and in St. Petersburg in 2011 and 2012, Putin was shocked, and he was really surprised to see that people organized on the social networks on the internet. They weren't organized by some party or some leader. They just organized by themselves using social networks. It was really surprising for the Putin, and he started his offensive on the internet.
Probably, but I would add one thing, which sometimes it's really confusing to see why we became so scared given the numbers of people protesting. I mean, actually, on the height of protest, we got probably 100,000 people on Moscow streets, which is, to be honest, not a very big number.
Right.
I mean, given the fact that we have how many, almost 14 million people living in Moscow, it's not that
right.
big. But nevertheless, they became really scared. And the reason is why is because the Kremlin believed that they've been in some sort of arms race with the State Department of the United States since at least 1999. That was the moment when we got this color revolutions thing in Belgrade. And the problem for the Kremlin, they believed that color revolutions present a kind of new tool for mobilizing people without, say, traditional ways of mobilizing people, like trade unions or opposition political parties put under control in Russia, many years back. And they went with some idea how to counter these, and the Kremlin launched their own pro-Kremlin youth movements, all of that to deal with this new technology invented by U.S. State Department. And then you got social media, and you got the Arab Spring. And for the Kremlin, that was a sign that the U.S. Department, U.S. State Department, came up with something new, something which actually is even more dangerous, because in this case you don't need any kind of organization, offline organization.
Right.
You can organize everything out of scratch almost spontaneously.
And imagine what happened to Yanukovych had to be really, really scary.
Yes, it was really scary. That was another example, and it was very emotional thing for Putin, because especially with his falling statues of Lenin, etc., because it's, of course, it's in a way it reminded Putin of 1991 and this failed putsch organized by the KGB, and we know what happened next. The statue of Dzerzhinsky was just destroyed, and we got the new Russia, much more liberal. So when you are in this kind of arms race, and you always trying to identify new signs of new weaponry invented by this ominous force of the United States State Department against you, and that's why when we got this first protest, we got scared.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of overreaction.
Right.
Not to the protest, but to what might be behind this protest.
Right. And this is where SORM comes in, which is the American transliteration or the English transliteration of a Russian acronym that stands for System of Operative Search Measures.
Absolutely.
But this predates the internet a little bit. I mean, this goes back to intercepting telephone traffic.
Right.
It was invented back in the 80s, late 80s
by the KGB. Actually, they tried to imitate Stasi success. And we spoke to many guys, generals of the KGB, and all of them told us how envious they were. Reading all these transcripts provided by Stasi, because we understood that Stasi was way forward, and they were much more advanced in technology than the KGB. So we wanted to do something like Stasi. Unfortunately for Russian citizens, all their plans were postponed because of 1991 and the collapse of the Soviet Union. So they introduced this system only in 1995, and the very first implementation for the internet we got by 1999. But of course, this technology have been developing ever since. So every year we are getting some new updates.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast, so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
And essentially, this is tapping into any kind of phones, but also internet, emails, without any kind of court orders or any kind of warrants that are above board, right? Yeah. So they're not, it's people talk, in the United States, we have the FISA courts, which are secret courts that have judges that determine whether or not a secret warrant can be issued. They seem as transparent can be compared to what is going on right now in Russia.
Yeah, because
SAR means unrestricted access to users' information. I don't know, officer can type really any identificator on the internet and get access to all your social networks, all your photographs, videos, and your phone conversations, IP phone conversation, and so on.
This system helps you to, well, actually let you mirror all the traffic. And there is a kind of requirement for getting a warrant, but it's a kind of joke, because the idea is that an FSB officer should get a warrant, but he has no right to show this warrant to anyone except his superior. And telecommunication company personnel, they have no right to see or to ask for this warrant.
And given the fact that nobody can control the FSB, we don't know whether they have to get warrant and every time when they need to intercept anybody.
So they're supposed to get a warrant, but there's no way to tell if they're getting a warrant or not, because you can't ask them if they have a warrant.
That's
right. I mean, FISA gets criticized because the approval rate is essentially 100%, but that's because federal prosecutors and people know exactly what's necessary to get a FISA warrant, and they don't bring it to FISA unless they have exactly what it is. And this sounds like there's just whatever you want to do, you can go ahead and do it. I read that there was last year, there was even a way to strengthen this law. It was based on an author, a parliamentarian, Irina Yarayava.
Yes.
I'm trying to read my notes and they're not very legible, which essentially kicks in next year, but it takes whatever little restrictions were left completely off the table, where they can, I love this phrase, they're allowed to take communications metadata as well as, quote, all other information necessary to authorities without a court order. I mean, that is as vague, basically taking it whatever they want.
It's provoked a lot of panic on the telecommunications market, because telecommunication companies and ISPs, they're just not ready to store all information of Russian users for 1 year.
No.
They're not ready to do this. And I don't know, it should be, the law should be working like this, that F-security services need some information on some particular people. They can get it, but it couldn't be for all. It couldn't be like mass surveillance, because it's, as far as we know from these telecommunications companies and ISPs, it's impossible to implement because of restricted abilities, restricted technical abilities of these companies. But this is for now. But in 5 years, it might be another picture.
Well, it's 1 year for that, but metadata, I think, is 3 years, if I remember reading it right.
Yeah.
So they have to, that information.
And also, it's interesting, there's this crucial difference between, say, Russian system and American system, that the Russian government tries to place all costs of surveillance on companies.
Yeah, so no, I said that too, they're forced to pay for it. Yeah.
Yes, so you actually, it's very cheap, like, and, well, NSA should have built this enormous facility in Utah to store all this data, and it was really expensive. In Russia, it's up to telecommunication companies to pay for all these things.
I think the NSA have to follow this idea.
Yes.
Not to pay for surveillance.
Yes, make AT&T and Google and everybody else do it. You talked about how Putin came late to the party of understanding kind of how the internet made a difference, but he seems to have embraced it and gotten on board pretty quickly. He's used it pretty effectively to surveil his political opponents, dissidents, foreigners for potential compromise. But even the people, the Sochi Olympics, there were a lot of warnings put out before that of don't bring any electronics that has any information on it, wipe everything clean, even if you're an athlete, if you're an official going along, because that was arguably the most surveilled Olympics in the history of the games. I mean, that he seems to have figured it out pretty quickly.
Yeah, because Sochi Olympics was meant to be kind of testing ground for surveillance, and it was not the very first time in Russian history, actually, when we had the Olympic Games back in the 1980 in Moscow, which was ignored by the United States and many other Western countries because of the invasion of Afghanistan. But nevertheless, it was used by the KGB as a testing grounds, and they introduced many things during these Olympics. I mean, in Moscow, trying to test them on and how it could work. And we got exactly the same thing after the Sochi Olympics. Mm-hmm. We tried many things, how to control, for example, Wi-Fi communications, how to control, how to install more CCTV cameras, how to work with biometrics. And now we're trying to expand this system and to use it everywhere.
Let me ask you, it seems that one of the fears of Putin is the internationalism of the internet, where it's not something that can be controlled as a national asset. And with the kind of nationalism that's happening inside Russia and now the United States, you know, it's messy. It's not something that's that easily controlled. Is that a root cause of some of the fears of the leadership that, you know, that someone from the United States or China or somewhere else can kind of reach into Russia and put ideas in? And
to be honest, it's a very, I would say it's a very traditional way of thinking for the Russian security services. I was very young and was my probably first month as a journalist, and I was sent to the Russian Parliament, the State Duma, for the hearings of the internet. It was the very first hearing in 1996, and I remember there was a general of the Russian security services who just said that the internet poses a threat to the national security of Russian Federation just because it's built on American technologies, it's an American invention, and we use American services. So this idea is still very popular, and of course Putin believes and his people believe that it's very important to install some borders to make the Russian internet Russian,
right.
to localize it. And it means, unfortunately, a lot of things, starting from putting pressure on telecommunication companies to trying to force global platforms like Google or Facebook or Twitter to move the servers into Russia and to store all data in Russia. And of course it would mean that finally we will get completely different versions of the internet. I mean, here or Brazil or Russia or Germany, it would be, they would lost this idea of a global network.
Well, you're seeing that in China a little bit, where the Chinese government is forcing these telecommunications companies to block certain websites that are critical of the Chinese government. I mean, they have the business power to force these companies to do it because they have the economic strength. Is Russia getting to that point where they can do that? I mean, you have people like Kaspersky and others that have a huge part of global internet business. But is the Russian economy strong enough to kind of force that issue?
Russian economy not so strong as Chinese, and it's also a big factor for the international internet companies. I think that the fact that the international internet companies refuse to move their service into Russia, which is a big deal for us, because until their service are here on the West, the FSB and other security services can intercept users' information, but they can't decrypt this. Mm-hmm. And we feel that our personal information is quite safe. And all these companies refuse to move their servers into Russia. That's really good for us. And I think that the main factor that Russian economy isn't so big as Chinese.
Right. Well, your book, Red Web, came out in 2015, but you've now, like I mentioned, it's been reissued because there's been some interesting developments in the last year or so. Does it amaze you that there are still some out there in the United States that are arguing against Russian shenanigans, interference in the 2016 elections? I mean,
Well, you know, but the Kremlin has been playing this game with deniable responsibility and saying, like, it's not us, it's someone else for years. And actually, we started many years ago, and we started first inside of the country. We got lots of say, communications intercept. I mean, we got lots of cases when you have Russian opposition leaders or independent journalists, their communications intercepted and then leaked to some pro-Kremlin websites, and the reaction of the Kremlin was always the same. Like, it has had nothing to do with us.
Right.
It was about someone else, some patriotic-minded people. So they try to play this game now and saying it could be someone else, maybe Russian, but not part of the government.
Right. I mean, that seems to be always the easy one. Like, oh, this hasn't been ordered by Putin himself. This is, these are some patriotic hackers who live somewhere in Moscow.
Yeah, wanted to please him, and he was not in the know. We do not believe in this theory because United States, and well, it was always, and it still is a very personal thing for Vladimir Putin. It's a very important thing for him because actually you should remember that in the beginning in 2000 he tried to please George W. Bush. He tried to win his trust. He made some efforts actually to please him. He decided to give up at least two military bases, one of them in Cuba, Lourdes alien facility, which was enormously powerful. And he gave up his military base, military facility in Vietnam. He was the very first foreign leader to call Bush after 9/11. Mm-hmm. So he tried to do something. He wanted to be respected. But when he decided that he was betrayed by Bush, he became so angry. So it was always very personal, which means, among other things, that you cannot do anything about U.S. election if you are not sanctioned from the very top.
Right.
It's a very special thing. It's just for Putin personally. It's very special.
And I think people in the United States don't... In the United States, the Panama Papers, the release of the Panama Papers, were not a huge, huge story. So I think a lot of Americans didn't quite understand how it applied to them and how it made a difference. And that seems to be, I mean, you've written about this, but that seems to be at the forefront of Putin's motivations for messing with the United States. Essentially, he blames almost like a personal attack on him and his inner circle of the top people.
Absolutely.
At the Kremlin.
And
that was the first time when Putin's personal money was exposed. They even was not sure that his personal money exists, because how did we know?
Right.
And journalists provide us with greatest proofs that this guy who is cellist accommodated on his network of offshore accounts something like $2 billion. And it was clear, and because he's a personal Putin's friend from his youth, it was clear that this is Putin's money. Mm-hmm. And it had never happened before. And Putin was furious, very angry at this, because everybody knows the rules, that nobody can touch Putin's family and Putin's money. Yeah,
what makes the whole thing worse, he believed that this attack was directed by Hillary Clinton's people. So for him, it was a kind of personal fight between him and Clinton, and given the fact that he sincerely believed that she had intervened into his election in 2012, so probably he believed that, well, it's fine to fight back.
How much do you think the Magnitsky Act plays a role in this, or does it at all? The sanctions that's placed on Putin's top people.
These sanctions have a big effect in Moscow, actually, and given the fact that Putin personally commented on these sanctions, and not once. I mean, it's a very big thing. It's because it's personal. It's about personalities.
Right.
It's a big thing. When you go after personalities, it's much more sensitive. So I think it was still huge.
It was effective and huge.
Yeah, but I think people don't understand that, you know, Putin certainly is in charge, but there's a kind of a group of very, very rich people who are Putin's inner circle, and his power comes from their approval in many respects. I mean, I think, you know, probably his biggest fear is losing that group who, if they turn against him, he's got big problems.
Or maybe he just believes that if his personal friends are under attack, it means that he's not powerful enough
to protect them.
He needs to show his strength. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So let me ask you about WikiLeaks, because many people say WikiLeaks, when it first appeared, right, was a positive institution for overall transparency and fairness. And I'm a historian at a spy museum. The idea of what Chelsea Manning did, I'm very torn about it, right? On one hand, it was information that we should have a conversation about. On the other hand, it was somewhat classified information. Snowden, I'm somewhat the same. So Assange and WikiLeaks was, I was torn about it at first because it seemed like there was something potentially positive about there. But now, not so much. And I think that it's a consensus, at least among those who have a little bit of information behind this, that in either the kind of the spring of last year or the summer of 2016, that WikiLeaks kind of went off, went off the reservation in the United States, where they became so closely tied to Russian intelligence that they lost kind of what they were founded on.
Of course, the WikiLeaks started as an independent organization, yeah. And they, made a lot of good. But then they transformed to some kind of Putin's supporters, Putin's proxies, which is very sad for us.
To be honest, we also believed in the beginning when we started back in 2010 probably that we were trying to do something good, and actually we worked with some of our friends. I mean, in Russia, when we got this big trove of documents from the U.S. State Department, they had some journalists in Russia working with them, doing some investigation. And some of these investigations were really good. The problem is that in 2016, WikiLeaks, I would say, completely changed their character, because they started attacking the same journalists they had been working before, because now these journalists were working on Panama Papers. And for us personally, it was a very shocking moment, especially because there was a strange change of events. So you have Panama Papers expose, next day, or maybe the same day, WikiLeaks attacking Panama Papers. And the very next day, Vladimir Putin had his press conference, asked about Panama Papers, and he said, look, now we know it's all about American conspiracy, the U.S. State Department, because we know that thanks to WikiLeaks.
Right.
And, of course, it was a very sad development. Next day, we were in Perugia, in Italy, at some journalism festival, and just by chance, there was Sarah Harrison from WikiLeaks there. So I asked her about that, and she was so, aggressive. She didn't want to take responsibility for this. She said, look, you can't hold me responsible for what Putin said, but I believe that there is something wrong with, say, integrity of journalists involved in Panama Papers investigation. So, of course, we sort of played this game, and we still play this game.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I think they've lost a lot of their fan club here in the United
States. Including us.
Yeah. No, I mean, the timing is, if anyone perhaps hates Hillary Clinton more than Vladimir Putin, it's Julian Assange. You know, they both seem to blame her for everything. And that, to me, you know, as I'm not a journalist, but I certainly know a lot of them, and I appreciate what you guys do. It's sad to see a potentially independent, non-governmental, I mean, journalists who, the ideals were there, right? And again, the Manning stuff, I half agreed, half disagreed with it. But the idea of going after governments and going after corruption and getting stories that no one would be willing to do otherwise seemed to be a lofty goal. And it was an organization that had the opportunity to do that and kind of just fell completely by the wayside. This, you know, being probably the worst thing you can do is getting in bed with someone like Putin and the oligarchs there. It's just, it's sad to me.
We share your frustration because, well, for us, the idea of transparency, well, it's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Well, we journalists, we want the security services be transparent. Not about their operations, but about many things they do.
Right.
And, well, in Russia, it's impossible even to establish who work for them sometimes. And, I mean, not operatives, but people in power. And it's all very secret in Russia. And so, of course, any kind of ideas which might contribute to the idea of transparency, we presumed it should be good. But, and at least it looks like now WikiLeaks tried to regain some of the reputation they had. They published something about Russian surveillance efforts, and they contacted us. But to be honest, it doesn't look very sincere. and it looks like just an effort to try to distance themselves,
right?
But not as
from the Kremlin.
From the Kremlin, yeah. But not as a genuine effort to make something transparent.
Do you see anything that's been done since the elections to try to punish or dissuade the Russians from continuing these kinds of operations being effective? Is there anything that's been done that you think will hit Putin in a place that that hurts? Whether it's sanctions, although getting sanctions is not as easy to do.
I would say that this indictment, FBI indictment of Russian hackers involved in an attack on Yahoo in 2014, that was a very big development. The very first time in the history of U.S.-Russia relationship, you got FSB officers on FBI most wanted mm-hmm. list. It's a very big thing.
Because transparency is always a very effective way.
You have some names.
Right.
Finally, we've been, speculating about the relationship between criminal hackers and the FSB for years. Now we got some proof, we got some information. That for many journalists, it became a starting point for their investigations. So it's added some information and helped a lot. So, no, I think, yes, that's probably the most interesting thing.
Are you optimistic about the future of journalism in Russia? Are you optimistic about being able to tell truth to power? Do you think it's heading in a good direction, or
it's completely different questions.
Right. Well, sorry. So, let me ask the question separately. Then, I mean, what direction are you going down before you go back up? Or do you see a potential happy ending to all this, or is it a constant fight? You know, what is the end game? I mean. Is it just to? I'm not trying to call you out. I'm saying, when you retire 45 years from now, and you look back at your life, and you would say, "I want to retire happy." What does that look like in Russia when it comes to journalism? What does success look like for you?
There should be more independent media in Russia, and we had a lot, but we lost most of them. But there are some optimistic things that is happening right now, because a lot of investigation into governments and the Kremlin's corruption is conducted by the activists, and they did good, really professional investigations, and they posted results on YouTube, and that's a great process in terms of transparency and in terms of to make the authority more visible, and to know and to get information about what they do in reality.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the lowest point. We already, I think it was about 2005, maybe 2009. Back then, journalists, we completely lost trust of our audience. It was, to be honest, it was a terrible time to be in Moscow. And the middle class, intelligentsia, they completely lost interest and trust in journalism. They traded off their political freedoms for, say, private freedoms to make some money, to go abroad, to get some mortgages and this kind of thing. But it looks like this period ended, and now we are living in a completely new reality. We are now. Once again, the Russian people became interested in politics. Maybe there are some crazy things, especially for people watching Russian TV. It sounds really crazy. With lots of accusations, lots of screaming, and some crazy stuff. But people got interested, mm-hmm. and it's a kind of it's the first step. Once you got interested, then the next step is just to find a proper way how to tell your story, how to convince people that you are integral, that you're independent, that your story is worth attention. So we believe that, actually, we are quite optimistic.
Yeah, because of the internet.
Mostly, yeah.
Mostly.
I mean, in the United States, you know, people say it's much not always able to challenge power at the top, right, to go right after the White House, but it's local elections, local governments. It's starting at the regional level. Do you start, and it's generational too, right? So younger generations at the local level are running for, you know, we joke around in the country, voting for dog catcher, but they're running for school board, they're running for local assemblies, they're running for state governments. Do you see that beginning where there is a grassroots movement in Russia at the province level, at the local level, working its way up to higher levels within the generations?
It's a bit more complicated because the Russian government, especially in regions, they know how to co-opt these kind of movements. But we notice it a very interesting thing. Sometimes it's really bad for the government to fire journalists, because many of these journalists end up in these grassroots movements. Mm-hmm. And we try to trace what actually happened to some of these grassroots movements after the protest. Some of them stayed where they are, helping local people, fixing roads and streets, this kind of thing. But some of them evolved into something much more political. And in many of these organizations, we found journalists. These guys were already political. Mm-hmm. They infiltrated themselves into these organizations, and then but we cannot stay at this level. We want to do something political. So finally, they turned these organizations into something political. So it's a good thing.
Yeah, and the last local elections in Moscow was very successful in terms of independent policy from the Kremlin, because we had a local election. We had an election, elections to local assemblies, and a lot of independent people got their places in these assemblies. A lot of independent candidates, including some independent journalists.
Mm. Well, let me wrap this conversation up. We could talk for a long time, but I know you're here in D.C. doing about 90 things. So let me wrap this up, the question about the cooperation between journalists of different countries, and specifically the United States. Right? How much do you work with journalists here in the United States? Is there a cooperation across international lines about trying to find innovative ways to make Russia more open, to make your jobs easier? Do you have allies here in the United States that are doing what they can to kind of help?
Actually, our books are published here only because of journalists, and because some journalists from the Washington Post helped us a lot. And we have a lot of friends here, and sometimes the problem is that you just need to have someone to ask whether you are still doing something according to journalistic standards.
Right.
And sometimes you cannot find this kind of thing and support in your country. And it's great that you have now the internet and you have all these technologies and you can ask people the people you respect. But also it's about some joint investigations we did. Sometimes it's really great. I mean, fortunately, we are not living in the Soviet Union. I mean, the Soviet Union was a kind of fortress,
right?
And everything about the Soviet Union was unique. Now we live in a global Russia, and Putin might pretend otherwise, but it's a global Russian. It means that Russia, which means that we have lots of Russians here, we have lots of interest, we have lots of businesses, a lot of exchange of information, which means that actually you might do something from here, something from there. And you can combine your forces and efforts, and finally you can produce something really, really interesting.
And work of OCCRP organization in, its investigation into the corruption of elite of many countries, starting with Russia and ending
just
with the United Kingdom.
Yes.
The very positive example of cooperation, of journalist cooperation across the world.
Well, the two books you might be most interested in are The New Nobility, The Restoration of Russia's Security State and the Enduring Legacy of the KGB. I believe that was a 2010-ish?
Yes,
all right, I got it. And The Red Web, The Kremlin's Wars on the Internet, which originally was 2015, but has now been re-released with new information on the U.S. elections of 2016. You may need to make a third edition in about a year, since every single day something new happens around here. Andrei, Irina, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us here. Thank you very much.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution to help support future educational programming. Please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.